Thank you for being a valued supporter of the 10X Podcast Group. Your dedication means the world to us. Today, we bring you a historical review of Haiti, a journey through time. Your continued support and subscription fuel our passion for storytelling, and we deeply appreciate every moment you spend with us. So, without further ado, let's dive into today's compelling narrative. Chapter 1, The Land Before Time. The First Glimpse of Paradise. Long before the turmoil of conquest and revolution, the island of Ayatai, the land of high mountains, existed in pristine splendor. A rich tapestry of emerald jungles and azure seas, the land seemed untouched by the hand of time. Towering mountains cradled fertile valleys, and rivers snaked their way through lush rainforests, spilling into the crystalline waters of the Caribbean. It was a paradise that the indigenous peoples would come to call home, a land where the sun kissed the earth with abundance. The first settlers of this paradise were the Tainos, a peaceful and resourceful people who arrived from the Orinoco Basin of South America. Traveling in large canoes across the open sea, they carried with them not just survival skills, but also a thriving culture, rich traditions, and a harmonious relationship with nature. Life of the Tainos. The Tainos were masterful artisans and agriculturalists, cultivating cassava, sweet potatoes, corn, and other crops in their canucos. Mound-shaped gardens ingeniously designed to prevent soil erosion and optimize water retention. Their villages, or ukiyeks, were clusters of thatched bohayos, huts, surrounding a central ceremonial plaza. Life revolved around this plaza, where they played batu, a ball game that was as much about diplomacy as sport, and held ceremonies to honor their gods, or zimis. Taino spirituality was deeply intertwined with their daily lives. They believed in a pantheon of gods who controlled the forces of nature. Rituals often involved cohoba, a hallucinogenic powder used by shamans to communicate with the spirit world. These ceremonies, with their rhythmic drumming and chanting, were both a celebration and a connection to the divine. Social harmony and leadership. Governed by a cacique or chief, each ukiyek operated under a system of shared responsibility and mutual respect. The cacique's role was not merely to lead, but to ensure the well-being of the community. The bohaik, or spiritual leader, provided guidance, healing, and a connection to the ancestors. Together, they upheld a balance that allowed their society to flourish. Marriage, trade, and communal work were integral to their way of life. The Tainos were skilled navigators and traders, exchanging goods like cotton, fish, and tobacco with neighboring islands. Their craftsmanship extended to pottery, weaving, and woodworking, creating tools and ornaments that were both functional and beautiful. A sustainable existence. The Tainos' relationship with their environment was one of symbiosis. They fished the coastal waters and rivers, hunted small game, and foraged for fruits and nuts in the forest. Yet they took only what they needed, ensuring the land's fertility for generations to come. Their respect for nature was not merely practical but deeply spiritual. Every tree, stone, and animal held a spirit, a guardian of the earth. Echoes of a forgotten world. The tranquility of this world was shattered in 1492 with the arrival of Christopher Columbus. But before the ships appeared on the horizon, before the clash of civilizations, Ayatai was a thriving, vibrant society. The land held stories in its soil, whispered through the rustling leaves and crashing waves. It was a world that seemed eternal, yet it would soon be swept into the currents of history. As the chapter closes, the reader is left with a poignant image. The Tainos gathered in their ceremonial plaza at sunset, the rhythmic beat of drums echoing across the valley, their laughter mingling with the songs of birds. Unbeknownst to them, their paradise was on the brink of irrevocable change. This chapter serves as a foundation, not just for understanding the land and its first inhabitants, but for appreciating the depth of what was lost and the resilience of what endured. Chapter 2, 1492, Columbus and the Turning Point. A world forever altered. On December 6, 1492, three ships under the command of Christopher Columbus approached the shores of an island he would name La Isla Española, or Hispaniola. To the Tainos, the sight of the towering ships resembled the arrival of gods or spirits from the sea. Little did they know, these vessels carried the harbingers of devastation and change. Columbus, a Genoese navigator funded by the Spanish crown, was searching for a new route to the riches of Asia. What he found instead was a land of breathtaking beauty, teeming with resources and a people he described as gentle and hospitable. His journals detailed the lush landscapes and the Taino's generosity, but beneath his admiration lay a sinister intent to claim the land and its wealth for Spain. The first encounter. The initial interactions between the Taino's and the Spanish were marked by curiosity and cautious generosity. The Taino's welcomed the newcomers with open arms, offering food, shelter, and gifts. Columbus marveled at their hospitality, but also noted their naivety, writing in his journal, "With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want." The Taino's viewed the Spanish as potential allies or supernatural beings, but this perception was quickly shattered. The Spanish sought gold, and the island's rivers and mountains held deposits of the coveted metal. The Taino's, who had little concept of wealth in the European sense, were coerced into revealing the locations of these deposits. The establishment of La Navidad. Columbus, leaving behind the wreckage of the Santa Maria, established the settlement of La Navidad on the northern coast of Hispaniola. He left 39 men there while he returned to Spain to report his findings. The settlement, however, was doomed from the start. The Spaniards' greed and lack of respect for the Taino way of life led to tensions, and when Columbus returned on his second voyage, he found La Navidad in ruins, its inhabitants killed in a conflict with the Tainos. The Taino resistance. The Tainos, led by caciques like Cayanabo, soon realized the Spanish were not visitors but conquerors. Resistance grew as the Spanish demanded more labor and resources. Cayanabo became a symbol of defiance, organizing attacks against Spanish settlements. Despite his eventual capture and deportation, his spirit of resistance ignited the hearts of his people. The Spanish, however, wielded advanced weaponry, including steel swords, firearms, and horses, which gave them a devastating advantage. Diseases such as smallpox, measles, and influenza, brought unknowingly by the Europeans, began to spread among the Tainos. With no immunity, the population was decimated, their villages left desolate. The Spanish encomienda system. By 1495, Columbus implemented the encomienda system, a form of forced labor that exploited the Tainos to extract resources, particularly gold. Men, women, and even children were subjected to grueling conditions, often working to death in mines and plantations. The encomienda system marked the beginning of systematic exploitation that would characterize colonial rule. The Tainos who survived disease and violence faced a life of enslavement. Their social structures, spiritual practices, and cultural traditions were systematically dismantled. The once thriving communities began to vanish, replaced by the rigid hierarchy of colonial rule. A fragmented legacy. By the early 1500s, the Taino population had plummeted. What was once a vibrant society of hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions, was reduced to a fraction of its former size. Some Tainos escaped to the mountains, forming maroon communities and continuing their resistance. Others intermarried with Africans brought to the island as slaves, creating the foundations of Haiti's Creole culture. Despite the devastation, fragments of Taino heritage endured. Words like canoe, hammock, and barbecue entered the European lexicon, and elements of Taino spiritual practices and knowledge of the land persisted in the folklore and traditions of the island. A land claimed, a people lost. As the chapter concludes, the Spanish have established a firm foothold on Hispaniola, setting the stage for the colonization of the Americas. The Taino world, once a paradise of harmony and abundance, is now a shadow of itself, swept aside by the tidal wave of conquest. The Spanish, emboldened by their success, turn their eyes toward greater ambitions, while the land itself bears the scars of their arrival. This chapter closes with a haunting image: a lone Taino woman standing on a hill overlooking the Spanish settlement, clutching her child. She whispers a prayer to the Zimis for strength and protection, her voice carried away by the wind. Below her, smoke rises from the Spanish forges, a stark reminder of the new world that has taken root on her ancestral land. Chapter 3. The Slave Trade and the Plantation Economy. A new wave of oppression. With the near-total collapse of the Taino population, the Spanish turned their ambitions toward another source of labor, enslaved Africans. By the early 1500s, the transatlantic slave trade had become a cornerstone of European colonial expansion. Hispaniola, with its burgeoning sugar plantations and lucrative potential, became a critical hub in this brutal system. The arrival of enslaved Africans marked the beginning of a new chapter in the island's history, one of unimaginable suffering, resilience, and cultural fusion. Forced from their homelands, men, women, and children were transported across the Atlantic in chains, enduring the horrors of the Middle Passage. For those who survived, Hispaniola offered no reprieve, only further subjugation under the plantation economy. The Middle Passage. The journey across the Atlantic was a harrowing ordeal. Ships crammed human beings into dark, suffocating holds where disease, malnutrition, and abuse claimed countless lives. Captives were treated as cargo, their humanity stripped away by the merciless machinery of profit. Survivors arrived on the shores of Hispaniola weak, traumatized, and disoriented, only to face a lifetime of forced labor. Building the plantation economy. Sugar quickly became the lifeblood of the island's economy. Vast tracts of land were cleared to establish plantations, transforming the landscape and fueling Europe's insatiable demand for sugar, molasses, and rum. These plantations required a vast labor force, and enslaved Africans became the backbone of this system. The plantation hierarchy was rigid and dehumanizing. At the top were European landowners and overseers, who wielded absolute power. Below them, the enslaved toiled under grueling conditions, working from dawn to dusk in the fields, mills, and factories. Punishments for resistance or perceived inefficiency were swift and brutal, often serving as public spectacles to instill fear and compliance. Life in bondage. The daily lives of enslaved Africans were marked by hardship and violence, but also by acts of resistance and cultural preservation. Housing was rudimentary, with enslaved individuals crammed into small, poorly built huts. Food was minimal, often consisting of scraps from the plantation owners' tables or provisions they could grow themselves. Despite the oppressive conditions, enslaved Africans retained elements of their cultural heritage. They sang songs, told stories, and practiced spiritual traditions that offered solace and a sense of identity. Vodou, a syncretic religion blending African spiritual practices with elements of Catholicism, began to take root during this time, providing both a spiritual refuge and a covert means of resistance. The African resistance. Resistance to enslavement was a constant undercurrent on Hispaniola. Enslaved individuals engaged in acts of defiance, from working slowly and sabotaging equipment to outright rebellion. The island's mountainous terrain provided a refuge for those who escaped, leading to the establishment of Maroon communities. These self-sustaining groups of escaped slaves became symbols of defiance and resilience, often raiding plantations and assisting others in their escape. Rebellions, though often brutally suppressed, were frequent and sent ripples of fear through the colonial elite. Each uprising was a testament to the unyielding desire for freedom and dignity, even in the face of overwhelming odds. Cultural fusion and survival. Over time, the blending of African, Taino, and European influences gave rise to a unique Creole culture. This cultural fusion manifested in language, music, cuisine, and spiritual practices, forming the foundation of Haitian identity. Creole, a language born from necessity and resilience, became the common tongue of the enslaved, allowing them to communicate across linguistic barriers. Music and dance, often performed in secret, became powerful forms of expression. Drums, banned by plantation owners for their association with rebellion, carried rhythms that spoke of longing, hope, and resistance. These cultural practices were not just acts of survival, but declarations of humanity in the face of dehumanization. The growth of slavery's shadow. By the late 1600s, Hispaniola was undergoing significant transformations. The Spanish, increasingly focused on their mainland colonies, ceded control of the western part of the island to the French. This region, known as Saint-Domingue, would become one of the most profitable colonies in the world, built on the backs of enslaved Africans. The seeds of revolution were sown in the brutal plantation system, where the enslaved outnumbered the free population by a staggering margin. The resilience and resistance of the enslaved would eventually erupt into a revolution that would change the course of history. But for now, the island remained a cauldron of suffering and survival. A silent storm brewing. As the chapter closes, the island's plantations hum with activity, their profits filling the coffers of European empires. Yet beneath the surface, a storm is brewing. In the quiet corners of the night, whispers of freedom pass from person to person, and the rhythms of forbidden drums echo through the darkness. The enslaved may be in chains, but their spirits remain unbroken, preparing for the battles to come. Chapter 4: The Fire of Rebellion, Seeds of Change. A smoldering discontent. By the late 17th century, the brutal system of slavery and the plantation economy in Hispaniola, especially in the French-controlled colony of Saint-Domingue, had created a volatile environment. The enslaved population, far outnumbering their oppressors, bore the weight of inhumane treatment, yet their spirits remained unbroken. The whispers of resistance, carried by the rhythms of forbidden drums and secret gatherings, grew louder. The seeds of rebellion were being sown in the fertile soil of suffering, injustice, and a longing for freedom. The Enlightenment and the winds of change. The 18th century brought the Enlightenment, a period of intellectual awakening in Europe. Revolutionary ideas about liberty, equality, and fraternity found their way to the shores of Saint-Domingue, carried by merchants, freed people of color, and plantation owners alike. These ideals, though initially championed by the colonial elite, resonated deeply with the oppressed. In 1789, the French Revolution erupted, shaking the foundations of monarchy and privilege. The Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen proclaimed, "Men are born and remain free and equal in rights." For the enslaved and free people of color in Saint-Domingue, this declaration was both a beacon of hope and a cruel irony. While white colonists debated how these ideals applied to them, the enslaved began to envision a world where they could claim these rights for themselves. The role of the Maroons. The Maroon communities, formed by escaped slaves in the island's rugged mountains and dense forests, played a pivotal role in the resistance. These communities were not just sanctuaries but centers of rebellion, where strategies were devised and alliances were forged. Leaders like François McCandle, a charismatic and skilled organizer, emerged from these communities. McCandle, known for his knowledge of poisons, orchestrated a campaign to undermine the plantation system by targeting crops, livestock, and plantation owners. Though he was eventually captured and executed in 1758, his legacy inspired future generations to fight for freedom. The Uprising of 1791. The summer of 1791 marked a turning point in the history of Saint-Domingue. On the night of August 22nd, a coordinated slave revolt erupted across the northern plains. It began with a secret meeting in Bois Cayman, a wooded area where Vodou priests, including the legendary Dudi Boukman and a priestess known as Cécile Fatmon, conducted a ceremony to invoke the spirits and fortify the enslaved for the battle ahead. The uprising was swift and ferocious. Plantations burned, and enslaved people armed themselves with whatever tools and weapons they could find. Leaders emerged from the chaos, rallying their people under the banner of liberation. The rebellion spread rapidly, shaking the foundations of colonial power and catching the French authorities off guard. The free people of color. Amidst the chaos, another group sought to define its role in the unfolding revolution. The free people of color, or Gens de Couleur Libres. This group, consisting of mixed-race individuals and former slaves, occupied a precarious position in colonial society. They were often wealthy and educated, but faced systemic discrimination and exclusion from political power. Leaders like Julian Raymond and Vincent Auguet petitioned the French government for equal rights, arguing that the principles of the French Revolution should apply to them. While their demands were initially ignored, their actions highlighted the fractures within Saint-Domingue's society and the shared desire for equality across racial and social lines. Colonial retaliation and escalation. The French colonial authorities responded to the uprising with brutal force, deploying troops to suppress the rebellion. However, the enslaved were fighting not just for survival but for a vision of freedom, and their resilience was unmatched. Skirmishes turned into battles, and battles turned into a protracted war. The rebellion was not without its internal challenges. Leaders often disagreed on strategies, and alliances between the enslaved, Maroons, and free people of color were tenuous at best. Yet, the shared goal of liberation kept the flames of resistance burning. A world watching. The events in Saint-Domingue captured the attention of the world. European powers, including Britain and Spain, saw the rebellion as an opportunity to weaken France and extend their influence in the Caribbean. They provided support to various factions, further complicating the already chaotic situation. Meanwhile, in the United States, where slavery was deeply entrenched, the rebellion was met with a mixture of fear and admiration. A glimpse of the future. As the chapter concludes, the colony of Saint-Domingue stands on the brink of transformation. The enslaved have demonstrated their ability to challenge colonial power, but the path to freedom is fraught with danger and uncertainty. Leaders like Toussaint Louverture, a former slave with remarkable intellect and military acumen, are beginning to emerge, hinting at the next phase of the revolution. The final image is one of resilience and defiance. A group of rebels, armed with machetes and torches, standing atop a hill as the sun rises over the smoldering remains of a plantation. Their faces are etched with determination, their voices lifted in a song of freedom. The fire of rebellion has been lit, and it will not be extinguished.